Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 183 of the Distraction Pieces podcast and the first episode, the first guest of the new year. Obviously, the drunk cast hung over slightly, hung around longer than desired, like the unwelcome guest at your New Year's Eve party. But thanks for coming back to us in the new year. It's great to have you all here. We've got an amazing guest to kick the year off. I've got a load pre-recorded, or I was recording a load at the end of last year, and I've got a load of guests lined up that are all just amazing. So this week's guest is Lena Headey, which is amazing. And then next week's guest is Paloma Faith. And yeah, after that, we've got Gus Khan, and I've got a load of other just amazing people lined up. So hell of a run of episodes for you here. But before we get into that, let's do some kind of some welcoming back in the new year. I hope you all had a good New Year's Eve. A lot of you will know New Year's Eve is one of my favourite days of the year, and I stay in normally on my own and watch a film and eat good food. The food was average this year. I always do a steak and some sides and that, and the sides I didn't really smash this year. But the film was great. I watched a film called A Brighter Summer, which is, it's really good. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, also I've been catching up on, I mean, over the Christmas period, I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of watching of shows, and I've caught up on, I smashed the whole series of The Deuce, D-E-U-C-E. Loved that. I finished off Punisher. Loved that. I smashed the whole season, the latest season of Peaky Blinders. Mind-blowing. Obviously amazing. I've gone through Black Mirror, wonderful as ever. So yeah, tons of good stuff. As ever, we're brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Which is where we've got tons of merch and stuff. And again, another shout out. Just thank you all for all the support over the last year. I know I mention the record label and the merch every episode, but it is amazing how many of you support. And I get messages from people who are like, look, I didn't particularly need a t-shirt or a mug or a DVD or a record or a jumper or whatever else, but I listen to the podcast every week. It's free. And I wanted to kind of contribute, and I love that. That's dope. I'm really excited about some of the merch I'll be launching in the new year. I've got this one thing that is something me and the wonderful Mr. Heggie have been working on for a while, and if we can make it as dope as we think we can, it's going to be a hell of an item. But and I'm not going to tell you about that because we've not even put it into production yet, so let's get that right. Also, before we kick off this episode, I wanted to, obviously the year's ended, so I've got the top 16 or the most popular episodes of 2017, and I wanted to tell you all them. I posted it on social media. In fact, speaking of social media, I posted my New Year's message. If you didn't catch it, go and watch it. It's a video. It'll be easy to find. It's a black and white video of me at the piano wishing you all a happy new year. So go and enjoy that. That's a special thing for you. But the top 16 guests, number one was James McAvoy, which is really pleasing to me because he was the first guest I did a press junket for. In general, for years, I've turned down press junkets because you tend to only get 10 minutes and it's just churning out the same stuff. That's not anyone's fault, but it's going over the same stuff about only one film. And James was one that I'm enough of a fan that I wanted to give it a go. And I said to him, I'll only do it if I can get 45 minutes. And it went really well. I think it was a really well executed. It kind of made me have to be more prepped. Anyway, number two was Goldie, which was a huge one because he's a wonderful guest, and a huge one because that episode, in fact, I won't say what happened in case you don't know, but that episode was reported on the TV news in Australia, in America, and in the UK, and all over Europe, I believe. It was in, I think, every newspaper in the UK reported on that episode. So, yeah, that was quite a special one. Number three was Matt Willis from Busted, and that was a great one because we talked about, the highlight of that for me was talking about his battle with alcoholism in the past and how he's got over that. Next up was Catherine Ryan, who was fantastic. She's just, I'm a big fan of her, and she's been one of the highlights of this year for me because that was a great podcast, but she's just been smashing on everything. Her stand-up on Netflix was great, and then she's been on loads of panel shows that I thoroughly enjoyed. She was on Frankie Boyle's end-of-year roundup thing, which I loved, with other previous Distraction Pieces guest, Sarah Pascoe. And who else was on there? I think that was all the ones who were previous guests. Obviously, Frankie Boyle's a previous guest. Number five, I'll run through these a bit. Number five was James Buckley. Number six was Garth Jennings. That was a fantastic one. Number seven was Rob Parker. Another great one talking about addiction, but from pain pills, from his days in sport. Number eight was Eddie Izzard. Number nine was Wim Hof. Number 10 was Ancilla van der Leest, and I was really pleased that that was in the top 10 because that was one of my favourite episodes and I didn't know how it'd go, but it's the only time I generally have a rule of no politicians, but I'd been trying to get Ancilla on for a while before she went into politics at the time of talking, and it was so eye-opening. It's a great one. Number 11 was Susan Wacoma, who's just fantastic, amazing. I got to go and chat with her in South London. Number 12 was Russell Howard, great episode and just an intelligent, articulate and lovely dude. What number are we on? 13 was Polar Bear. I'm really glad that that was a high ranking one because Polar Bear is on Speech Development Records. He's a dude I've known for years. I consider him one of my closest friends, even though we don't get to hang out loads. So that was a great one. Number 14 was Michael Fassbender. That and Eddie Izzard and Armando Iannucci and S. Craig Zahler were all ones that kind of come off the back of the James McAvoy one, because they're all ones I did on press junkets, and James is the one that made me break that, and I think the Eddie Izzard and Fassbender ones are two of the best I've done, so the breaking of that was a big thing. Next up was Huey Morgan, who was fantastic, and I guessed on his podcast as well. And at number 16 was Gemma Kearney, which was a fantastic one too. So that's been the top 16. I'm going to stop rambling on now. I'll talk to you more in next week's episode, or at the end, in fact. Also, We Are Lizards, my club night, is back on Saturday, January 27th at the Book Club, joined by Don Letts, the living legend that is Don Letts. So come on down to that. It's a fiver to get in. It's free before nine, a fiver after. So come and kick it with me, Stu and Chris from the Hardcore Listening Podcast, Discotheque Credits, DJ Destruction, and the legendary Don Letts. I'll be DJing in a rubber lizard mask, so come and wave at me. Let's get into this. Elena was amazingly welcoming and open. I went and had a chat with her in her hotel room in London, and we talked about everything. Obviously, she was one of the people that spoke out against Harvey Weinstein. So some heavy conversation there, but again, having these open conversations is absolutely key, and she was wonderful about that. And she was obviously in Game of Thrones, which I adore. She was in Dread, which is one of my favourite films. So there was loads to talk about. I'll let us get into it now. See you at the end with more info. See you in a bit. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. Just,
I've got nothing to promote.
Talk casually. That's what I like. I like catching people. It weirds people out, because it's only this year I've started catching people on press runs, because in general, I prefer it when there isn't anything to promote. And on my side of it as well, I've started recording, by the way. I've done that casual podcaster thing of just jumping into it.
You sneaker.
But where, like, this year I've had three trips to LA to have meetings with casting directors, but it's because there's not anything I want at the moment, and I'd rather meet them when I don't want anything from them, and we're just having a
smell
discussion.
Your desperation.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than, or even just that I know that I'll be trying to tell them what they want, to show them what they want, and things like that. And it's like, I don't want that. I want them to meet me.
Use it a casual and then if something comes up, the character.
Yeah, if something comes up that works, then we're a fit. I don't want to go in there going,
full
I have
costume.
To be who they want to, which is probably bad as an actor. I should be wanting to be what they want to be. That's kind of acting,
no,
isn't it?
I think you're very smart, because then it takes years to sort of think they can smell your desperation.
Yeah.
To be and do something.
Yeah,
it's a fucker.
And it's why everyone I know always talks about how the coldness of LA and the horribleness of it. I've had lovely times out there, but I realised that's because that's the reason. I've just been going out excited to meet the casting director who casted Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I love that.
That's wicked. And things like that. I'm just there going, oh, I met some really nice people, and they said nice stuff, and I got a free glass of water. It was wicked.
So I had a meeting on the 19th millionth floor. It is, I mean, it is. It's such a weird old, not old, but a weird city.
Yeah.
Desert.
Yeah, it's a strange one, but that's it. I think it's horrible and nasty if you want something from it. It's that thing, it's like a night out. If you meet someone on a night out and you're buying them a drink because you want to buy them a drink,
yeah,
and you have a nice night out either way. If you're buying them a drink because you want them to sleep with you, then you're outraged that they didn't sleep with you. That was never an agreement. That was never entered into by everyone.
That was one-sided.
That's your own fault for it being a rubbish night out. So I spent 100 quid and then I went home alone. So, well, that's on you. That's not on the night out. That's not on... Yeah, I've got mates who have moaned to me and that kind of thing. And I'm always like, I don't want to tell you, mate, you chose to do that.
Shocking and horrible.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like I was talking to a friend of mine recently who was saying with nights out at a casino. It's Bashy, who's an actor I like, I just did a little film with. And he was saying his thing with casinos is he decides how much he's going to spend on enjoying his night and writes it off.
Yeah.
And then if you win or lose, it doesn't matter. He's saying, I'm taking 200 quid because I'm enjoying a night out with my mates. And then you don't have that, I lost 200 quid tonight. It's like, no, that's how much my enjoyment
costs.
That's
what I do in Sainsbury's.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'm only going to spend 200
quid. Here's all I'm going to spend. Well, I should introduce you. I'm joined by Elena Heady. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And you're in London at the moment. You've been doing some voiceover bits and stuff. It's probably stuff you can't talk about, right? That's generally the normal.
No, I can tell you. I'm doing some Mercedes adverts.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And how's that?
Yeah, good fun. And then I'm off to do Trolls.
Amazing.
Troll Hunters for Netflix.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's Troll Hunters? Who's doing that? Is it Guillermo del Toro?
Yes.
So is it anything to do with the Troll Hunter film, or is it to do... Because it was the Troll film, which is very different from Troll Hunter.
Yes.
Which Troll Hunter is?
No, it's a kids' cartoon series.
Amazing.
And so it's season 2 is coming out in December, I think.
Awesome.
Which we're in. And yeah, so I play the baddie.
Amazing. And how's that? Do you enjoy it?
Love it.
A voiceover stuff.
Love. More than anything, because you don't have to go as hair and makeup.
Yeah.
Never really have to be in a studio before 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite of filming.
And you get to mess about a lot.
You just get to be a big idiot, which I love.
Yeah. And do you do a lot of them with... Because I know it varies. Do you do a lot of them with the full cast there, kind of all bouncing off each other? Is it general you turn up and do your bits?
I think if you do a big, you know, animated movie,
yeah.
which I'd love to do,
yeah.
if anyone's listening. And I think then when you're in the studio, you all sit together, like, shooting
right,
a film.
Right, yeah, of course.
Which is kind of great fun.
Yeah.
But the little cartoons, like I did Danger Mouse and stuff like that, you just go and do your own stuff.
Yeah.
And they're always linked up by a camera, I think, so they can see you not being lazy.
Yeah.
They're like,
so you can tell you're trying hard and doing
if you're
it properly.
Like, yeah.
I love it.
Be more animated.
Yeah. And is that, has that, or has there been more motivation to do stuff like that since you've had a family? Is that something that drives you in that direction? I remember hearing a lot of people with comic book stuff. I remember Stephen Fry with Harry Potter saying he did it because of his nieces and nephews.
Would be hugely excited to have your children, you know, something where you're not having sex with your brother, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. That's. I mean, you've done a lot of stuff that they're not going to be able to watch for a while, and when they're old enough, probably won't want to watch.
I don't think they should ever see that.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. So, yeah, it must be nice to do bits that you can go... I mean, Danger Mouse.
Well, I do, and then you show them, and then my son's like, yeah. Anyway, have you seen that red bit of Lego? You can't impress them. I just went away with Bear Grylls for a couple of days, and thinking my son, you know, I was like, my son and my daughter will, my daughter, she'll think, oh, mummy does stuff that sort of men do in a lot of things. Do you know what I mean? That's all they see. And I thought, Wiley's going to, you know, dig it, because I don't hold a tarantula, but I hold a tarantula on a stick, which for me is a fucking massive thing.
Right,
I hate them.
Yeah.
And I was so proud. And he literally couldn't give two shits.
Yeah. Because it's not something that they've been taught should be scary yet.
No.
It's not something they've been taught is a big deal. So it's like,
he's
all
right. Bug lunatic. He was like, yeah.
Cool.
So like, you sit. That was it.
I was like, I would be cuddling that thing. You're like, no, that's not.
No.
That's not the point.
No.
This is a huge thing to overcome.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing to see, though, right?
to see the lack of inhibitions of children.
Yes.
A friend of mine who's a writer, he does a lot of workshops now, and he was saying hanging around with his children has helped him hugely, because you can't be cool and you can't be the cool person or whatever else. You have to drop all coolness and all inhibitions, because they don't give a shit. Don't, and it's helped shit. Him then in performing with adults or doing other stuff, because it's like, who cares?
Yeah.
I spent an hour with a bear on my head earlier just to make an idiot laugh. So I don't mind about pretending to be I'll be a tree and whatever else in workshops. It opens them up.
Yeah. I mean, my son at 7 is already really embarrassed of me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I thought that happened. I thought I had a few years left, but he's already a bit like, he does that thing, you know? You say something in front of his mates, like, yeah.
I've not got any kids, but I've already given up the idea of, or realised that there's no point in trying to be a cool parent.
I thought you were going to say trying to have children.
No, that's worth trying you into it.
That's just a nightmare.
I mean, the trying's the best bit, arguably.
the trying doesn't happen afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Just so you've done it. Succeeded.
Don't need to do it again.
Well done.
Yeah.
Job well done.
Job done.
Ticked off the list.
Yeah.
Popped on a certificate.
Never have to do that again.
I was at a festival with Billy Bragg and his son. And Billy Bragg, particularly for someone growing up in Essex, is Billy Bragg. He's an absolute legend. He's the coolest guy in the world. He's the first person I heard singing in my accent.
Right.
Well, so we can do that. It doesn't have to be Americans. And his son was so embarrassed of his dad and was just so kind of just like, oh, just leave me alone. Just wanted to be on his own. And he was going to go. And I was like, right, so if Billy Bragg can't be a cool dad, and Billy was playing that festival in one of the main slots, and still his son's like, oh, stop it, dad, stop embarrassing me. So yeah, it's not possible.
No, boys are weird at certain ages. They just think, I just want to be away from you, but I still kind of need you for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still that dependence. Do you,
how's it go?
This will be the first podcast in the new year.
Right.
And we're ending a year.
Shit.
That's been a weird one, right? For women, for the acting industry, for everything else. But the thing that feels good to talk about at this point is, as we sit here now, this week, Time Magazine has just announced their Person of the Year.
Yes.
It's the Silence Breakers, and it's the people who've spoken out. And you were one of those people that's spoken out in horrific situations. So looking back at the year at the moment, how do you feel about this year? Does it feel like a positive thing? Because obviously it's everything that's gone on is horrific, but it's positive that it's being spoken about and brought to the forefront and being held accountable, right?
Yes. I mean, I think it's, it's about time. And the funny thing is, you know, I told my story. It's that strange thing of, you know, the brilliant kind of Silence Breakers that spoke out first, and then us lot who went, oh my God, it wasn't just, you know, I had that realization. I was like, that wasn't just me, which was extraordinary to me. It sort of blew my mind. I genuinely had no idea.
Yeah.
Even though everyone was like, everyone knew in the industry, I was like, I hand on heart, didn't know.
Yeah.
But then I was speaking to a friend the other day who said, what about all these women in the industries that aren't, it's not being talked about, you know, who work day-to-day stuff that isn't like in the news all the time, because it happens it happens every day, everywhere, every job that goes on.
That's what I was going to say. In every workplace,
there
will be the boss in the office. There will be all these different things. So I had someone ask on the podcast how I feel about why it's so prevalent in the acting industry, and I was like, I don't necessarily think it's more prevalent. It's just everything in those areas are more in the public eye.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's discussed in a bigger deal, and it's a good thing, because that then hopefully bleeds out to everyone. I think a lot of people say, well, how come everyone's speaking about it now? And it's like, as you said there, it's the realisation that it's not just you. I think there is a lot of, the way society is built is there's a lot of
shame
and keep it a secret.
Anything that happens to you that is perceived to be your doing, your fault, your invitation, you carry a certain amount of guilt until somebody, whoever that person may be, says something, you know, and suddenly you feel that you're holding a hand and you're able to speak out.
Yeah.
So I think the sort of freedom and the space to do that more and more about everything is happening.
Yeah, completely.
But it's got a long way to go, of course. And then suddenly it seems as soon as it comes out, as soon as we talk about it, it then sort of becomes a joke as well, which I fucking hate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, completely. It becomes a hot topic. And it's an interesting one because I think there's not an easy answer to the explanation for any of it, for the secrecy, the privacy and all these other things. But there's a lot of things that contribute to that. And someone I was watching, I went to see a screening of Lady Bird this
week. Is it brilliant?
It's amazing. Can't it's wait absolutely to see that. Wonderful. And Greta was doing a speech, a Q&A afterwards. And she was saying, not even on that subject, but more on the push of women writers now, is as a young girl, girls are taught to write in a diary and keep it locked away and literally have a lock on the diary and keep it a secret and no one's allowed to read it. Whereas if boys write, they're kind of, you should write something, you should do a performance in front of the family, you should do this and do that. And that sounds overdramatic, but it's true. And that's a thing. If there's been brought up on a society of keep these things a secret and keep these things literally locked away. I remember Keepers as a toy when I was a kid that girls had, that they were these little toys that had a lock on them.
Right.
And it was to keep all your little secret things in. That's and things like that are just toys that have got a lock on them in general. That's a weird thing, but diaries that have a lock on them and you keep them under your bed and they're hidden and it's all... It's a strange thing, right?
It's also the boys' club, you know, versus... I mean, people still... And I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just... I don't know. It's interesting, you know, having a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
The immediate thing people say about my daughter, and I'm guilty of it too, going, she's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And when they say about, he's funny or he's brilliant at Lego.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's sort of, we're born with those comparisons. So boys are always like, it's sort of great.
And there's pressure on both of them. There's pressure on both of them in many ways, you know, but
women are sort of somehow made to compete from birth.
Yeah. On the stuff that they can't control as well.
Yes.
On beauty, that's something that's completely, a lot of the male stuff, well, if you train it or learn it, then you can get better at it. There's obviously people who are naturals at comedy or at writing or whatever else, but still, there's skills that can be learned to an extent. Whereas beauty, cosmetic advances aside, isn't necessarily something that you can learn or that you can train yourself. You can be comfortable with and you can learn your own interpretation of beauty. But let's kind of address that or refer to that then more as the stereotypical definition of beauty or standard of beauty.
But especially in our, this industry... that I've been in for 25 years, you know, that sort of competition within levels of beauty, it's really tragic. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're not allowed, you can't be a great character actress if you're pretty. You're just not allowed to be. It doesn't. No one is prepared to accept that. And by the same standards, like, well, if you're not pretty, you can't be this kind of leading sexy woman. And I think that is changing, thank fuck. But it creates this sort of illness within women in the industry where you just compete against each other, and that sort of plays into all of that fucking weird misogyny that goes on. So I think this has sort of really shifted everything into a different mode, and the awareness of it is brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think women are looking at each other very differently.
Yeah. And that's a good thing as well.
It's brilliant.
I think there is negative, or there is a problem with tribalism. I think the more we divide into the girl group and the men group, it's a negative thing. I think men should be as disgusted at the men who act badly as women are, and things like that. Do you know what I mean? I think it should be more crossover. But equally, the more unity in any group is a better thing. If it's not, again, it's a cliche to say there's more bitchiness or sniping.
We're recognising each other as not as, and it doesn't separate the men. It doesn't at all. Completely. I think that's all the men that are like, you know, anti-feminism is the death of, it's not, it's just inclusion. It's totally inclusion.
Have you seen the film The Red Pill?
No.
I recommended it to me, and it's a woman that made a film about feminism and ended up kind of being against some feminism but pro men's rights. And I really wanted to enjoy it, but it infuriated me as a film because it built false conflicts, in my opinion. It was saying how men have a higher rate of suicide, which I've worked with Calm for years, which is a charity that's about male suicide. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because they have, in society, they have more pressures to be the bread provider and the man and the strong person. And that's true. But that fits in with feminism.
Yes.
Because if there was more equality in jobs, they wouldn't have that pressure to be the man and the provider. It's like seeing that as a compromise. And the argument there was like, well, how come men aren't getting as much attention as women going through? It's just like, you're making it. It should be the same thing.
People
arguing for men's rights, 99% of the things that you have an issue, if you look at the things that are on the feminist kind of list, they match.
We're like
they complement
that. We just
each
need
other.
To come a little bit in together. And
realise it's not a competition. Realising that supporting women doesn't mean
you're
attacking
lesser.
Men. And yeah, exactly. Or equality doesn't. Equality isn't taking from anyone. It's levelling, it's topping up.
Rather than
pouring out as such.
There's that documentary, that Netflix documentary about American men who were like, be a man.
Yeah.
Show your balls.
Yeah.
Grow some balls. You know, all of that stuff. And it's sort of, that's quite dodgy. And yet you do have to teach boys to be brave because some of them aren't born brave and aren't born, you know, I keep referring to them because I know them the best. You know, my son's incredible and super sensitive. And I encourage that. But also it's like you've got to find some level of belief.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Completely.
And my daughter's sort of born with this strange, bring it. It's weird.
Yeah.
So it's like tempering the two of them slowly.
to balance them out.
Yeah, I'm like, come on. And down and up and stuff like that.
You need more confidence. You need a little less confidence.
You need to,
you're really getting
you
out of control
stop
here.
Answering the phone at two to everyone.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I mean, again, as someone who's spoken out and been at the forefront of this and been one of the people rightfully praised for bringing this to the front, one of the concerns I've had in it, and I hope you're clenching up and panicking now that I'm going to be, it's not fair, it's dangerous, it's hard to be a man at the moment. That's all bullshit. I hate all that
kind of,
it's a tough time to be a man in the industry because you're all, no, if you're a good man, it's not tough.
Yes.
But the thing that I've noticed is I think we need to get something. All the current generations don't have is enough awareness and sensitivity to nuances and the fact that things can be bad, but not as bad as other things. And that's not saying that they're good or acceptable. And with a lot of stuff that's coming out, with, for example, and I've said this on one or two, I think the Louis C.K. stuff, it makes my skin crawl. It's grim, it's creepy, it's unacceptable. But I also don't think it's as bad as some of the stuff that I've read that Weinstein has done or that Kevin Spacey has done. And there's levels of nuances. So I think one thing that we have to be careful with is not just putting it all in one basket because I feel it dilutes some and tops up others.
No,
do you know what I mean?
It's really tricky. I mean,
and people feel that's a defence. It's not at all. I think completely
I totally hear it. I tweeted Louis C.K. just to call him out. Sort of that his apology, which didn't ever mention the word sorry.
Mm.
Was sort of extraordinary to me. Just to, I wasn't on a massive rant about it. It was just that I would call anyone out that was, you know, I just said I was really sorry. It was like, it was fucking self-serving bollocks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't notice that, but that's a great point. If it's written in that manner and there's not the
not
word
mentioned.
Sorry, there was a lot of, because again, I don't think,
I don't think an open
letter apology is enough. I think it's a good start, but I don't think it's enough.
But saying the women were so in awe of me, I just had to go there.
Right, yeah.
Is what he was saying. So it was like, oh, Louis, soz.
Oh, how do you have to deal with that?
Soz about all that control you had.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
It's a tough one. Because, again, I can completely agree there. But again, there's levels. I'm glad he said something or tried to make some step. If he just ignored it, as many have, then that would not be good either. But yeah, again, it's such a complex area, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
But it's allowed to be a complex area.
I also think because he's very funny, people don't want to say he's been a shitbag.
What a creepy prick, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite interesting, you know, there are levels of like, well, he is, but he's also really great. Do you know what I mean?
Louis was one that I tweeted about, and I try not to talk about it much because I feel if I can't add anything personally, then it's just, it's self-serving. Do you know what I mean? I'm not involved in it. It's for me to say this is bad, but I tweeted about Louis to say that it's unacceptable because I felt it was important for me to do so because Louis is someone that I was a fan of.
Yes.
So it made
well,
it,
me too,
it
me
felt
too.
That because I'd tweeted at some point just saying what a piece of shit Weinstein was, I don't know him, easy target. Whereas when it's someone that I've watched a lot of, I felt I only did one post about it, but it was like, look, I feel I have to say something because this is, again, it's different.
You've let me down.
This still needs to be said. It would be unfair of me to attack someone who, I don't give a fuck about Harvey Weinstein. He's clearly disgusting. Whereas I do care about Louis, so it's important to say, yeah, that sucks.
I just introduced a girlfriend of mine to his stand-up, like, 2 weeks before, and she texted me, she went, oh, fucking hell, not. And I was like, I feel so responsible in a way. Yeah. I was like, you know, love what he does, and I can separate that.
Yeah.
It was the non-apology that just riled me.
Yeah. I like that.
In public.
That point, though, of the separation of stuff. I had someone tweet me saying, how do you feel about enjoying films that Weinstein was involved in now? And my argument was, I feel almost a greater responsibility to do so, because how can you tarnish everyone that worked really hard on that because some piece of shit has got his name at the top of it? And that was like, I don't think that's fair. I think R. Kelly is an example, and Louis C.K. are examples of people that I think they're talented, but I've no desire to enjoy their material at the moment.
Yes.
That's my choice, and that's my position. Whereas with Weinstein, it's like, well, I'm not gonna. It's more of an insult to let him ruin what all these people have worked on.
It gives him a bit more power, doesn't it? It's exactly, like you don't really want to do any more of that.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, again, we're not going to talk about it the whole time. But one thing I wanted to discuss is, how do you feel we can all act to make sure that this isn't just that was the big news story of 2017? Because as you said, as soon as something becomes in the public eye, it becomes this talking point. But we're really quick to move on from these talking points, and it can be the hope would be that you returning to the Hollywood film industry in 2018, you're kind of returning to a different place than you were last year, because so much has been exposed, so much has been said, so many scumbags have been identified and pulled down. And even those that haven't should know that, I don't know, they've had a clear sign that it's not acceptable. Yeah, rein it in, boys. There should be real change, right? Do you feel that's the case?
I do.
Do you feel it's something that we can maintain rather than, as I said, my big fear was, oh, that'll be now, that was the talking point of 2017, and then a few years on, we'll forget about it and it's gone.
I think it will change for sure. I think because it is high profile, because everybody is allowed to have a voice in our industry, there's probably going to be a little bit more consciousness about it all. You'd hope the behaviour would change.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think for some people it won't.
Yeah.
But people will carry on talking.
Yeah.
That's the joyous thing. And then hopefully it will spread to other industries.
Yeah, completely.
And then that will change.
Yeah. I think social media has played a big part in it as well, because there's a lot of people that it feels like, well, people had been talking about it for a while, but in closed circles.
Yes.
And not realising that their closed circles are closed.
But there's
so
also,
as
there's
soon
also
as it
that.
Became this huge thing, it's like, right now, everyone can discuss it, and it's out there, which feels, again, it feels like a beautiful warning shot to any of the people who've got that in their head. It's like, right, you're not going to get away with that shit anymore.
No, somebody will say
it's
something.
It's modern times. You can't get away with that. And that's a good thing, right?
We're fucked.
Yeah, exactly. There's no escaping this, guys.
No escaping. But let's hope it just spreads to everywhere else where people aren't necessarily on the front of, you know, newspapers talking about it. It'd be great to give everybody a voice where it happens. And it's kind of really hush, hush, dark.
Yeah, completely. Well, I mean, I do want to get on to film and TV stuff, because you've been in some of my favourite things, and one of them I'll mention now, and we'll talk about in a bit. No, Dread is one of my favourite films of all time, and I thought I was looking when they were auctioning off the costumes and stuff like that, because I think it's absolutely amazing and underrated, and one of the first that used 3D cinematography rather than just 3D.
Yes,
but we will discuss that shortly. But before we do, I wanted to talk as well. You mentioned newspapers then and headlines, and
not that I read newspapers, obviously.
No, but I know Twitter. There's an area that you are passionate about that something's happened recently that I've been stunned that there hasn't been more news coverage of. But in all this Brexit furore and everything that's going on, it was almost ignored. I think it was on November 11th. In November, they've pushed through the choice to not transfer the EU ruling that animals have can feel pain and are conscious sentient beings. So one of our changes of leaving the EU in our new British jurisdiction is that animals can't feel pain. How is this not hugely... Why aren't there people in the streets arguing and being furious that someone on paper has written down, it has now been decided that animals can't feel pain? I could write down that all of them PMs can't feel pain and then go and test that and you know, see how that works.
We but should test that.
It's amazing, right, that stuff like that can be pushed through. And I know you've done some animal rights activism and stuff in the past. And
yes.
It's mind-blowing to me.
I mean, I think it'll be addressed. I think everyone's just sort of bewildered right now about everything, aren't they? So that's yet another sort of level of insanity that's happening.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? I don't fucking know what we're doing. I mean, I really don't. It's like, I feel like suddenly we could do that. Ireland could just write, we're all actually just on a big arc.
Yeah.
Like, that wouldn't surprise me now. Like, that's been the plan all along. I don't know.
Yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it? That we live in this little world where we're genuinely a country in flux and have been for a long time. Because
we
don't know what the Brexit stuff is.
No one knows what it means.
And no one does. And everyone on the news always says, if we did go back on it, but no one actually talks about going back. I know I said we could go back on it, but no one actually, because again,
there's no moving forward and there's no going backwards.
I'm one of the few people...
All we know is that animals don't feel pain.
Exactly. And that's the kind of stuff that scares me. And the reason I was against... I'm one of the people that I want Brexit to go through because I think we're stupid enough to vote for it and we need to live through our... That's how we learn. You know, I think it's something that should never have been put in the public's hands because you don't ask your kids to choose what projects that you should do in the next 4 years because they're not going to know. you know, you ask.
Do you know what you said? That I thought actually I will. That's
you should. That's a better way to do it. Yeah. Here's the choices. But do you know what I mean? It's a weird one, and I feel.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was so much demand of the public of we should have a say in this. Like, so what's it about? I don't know. But we should have a say in it.
No, but we get all that money back.
And that's a big thing now, because of social media and because of all these other things that we all feel... This is an odd one, but I feel TED Talks are partly to blame for it, because it's that opinion that everyone has to have an important and valid opinion on everything.
On everything.
And we don't. We don't. We've got... Our opinions on our areas of expertise are hugely valid, but...
Mine are quite narrow there, but yeah.
Same. It's why I've turned down three or four different TED Talks, because they've said, oh, you can come and talk about something. I've got nothing of importance to say, which is weird from someone who's done a podcast every week for 3 years now. But still, it's like I don't feel I've got anything I can give this great importance to. Yet we all have that from a Facebook update
to whatever else. But also we're all asked to speak on things as well. Yeah. And then you think, I have to have an opinion. Like, I have to say something. When, like you say, you're not necessarily qualified.
A Brexit, right? That we were, like, told that we should have an opinion of it.
Yes.
Therefore, everyone had an opinion on it when not even the people who were experts.
Some people have got really great opinions on it, haven't they?
Yeah, some wonderful opinions on it.
In a cab.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, completely. And Trump's another example of that, of all the people who had a great opinion on him and then his tax reform is going through and screwing over the bulk of the people who... wanted him to make America great again.
Yeah, because they believed he was going to save them from fucking a dire existence.
Yeah. It's madness.
At least she's handsome.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's that. Let's talk about acting and your career. Was acting always something that you were planning to do and wanted to do? Was that what you were as a kid? Were you your son or your daughter? Were you the confident one or the more quiet and sensitive
one? Bit of both.
Probbers.
I mean, I wanted to do it. I just, you know, it wasn't really an attainable thing. Yeah. You know, I'm from a little village in Yorkshire and my dad was like, well, you're going to have to go to school, and university, and then maybe drama school, and then maybe, you know, and I was like, no, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And then... right time, right place at 17, I got an offer. And then I started working from 17. It was insane, you know. Amazing. But until Thrones, I was just in this, you know, doing what we all do, which is going to auditions, trying not to smell of desperation for certain jobs, you know, and just making it work. You know, that's the funny thing. Everyone's like, oh, you've made it. And it's like, there was years before that.
Yeah.
I feel incredibly lucky to have had this moment. And that's
the thing that I find quite fascinating about this industry and coming from music where there's kind of more control is the submission of control. Of you don't, you do a project and you don't know if it's going
to
be a good project.
You've just got
you
to
can
enjoy
go and
it.
Do your best and do it amazing, and it can feel at the time amazing. Then when it comes out, it could be bullshit, or vice versa. You could have one that's like, that was a horrible few months, really conflict constantly.
Yes,
but something in there pulled out this amazing piece. So
yeah,
it's a weird industry for that and a weird world of that.
But that's, I think that takes a long time to sort of grasp or surrender to. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's hard because if you think on different levels of visuals or, you know, just writing and story and all that stuff, it's quite hard to just be an actor. I don't mean like just be an actor, but you do have to just give it all up and enjoy the journey and think, exactly, I have fuck all control if they use that tape where I thought, fucking nailed that. Do you know what I mean? Then you turn up and it's not in, but there's like other... You never, ever know. Yeah. And I think that takes a while to stop feeling disappointed because you thought you were in control of it and you really have completely fuck all to do with that.
And when you can give that control up, it's liberating,
yeah,
right?
It's quite
because if you're busy, then the reality is by the time that film comes out, you can't particularly remember what the best take was. Do you know what I mean? You've moved on because you've done another project and another project.
Yes.
But it's kind of, it's just there now. So that's got to be a nice thing in many ways to not have that. It must be hard for a director or editor or whoever else to have that, to start it and then continue to be focused on that for months and months when you get to go, here it is. I'll see you later.
Like a big puke.
Yeah,
and then you're on to the next.
Here's everything. Goodbye.
Yeah.
I love that. So were there jobs along the way that made you question that career path?
Hmm.
And were there jobs that made you go, no, this is right. I'm doing the right thing. Or was it always, no, this is what I do now. This is it.
Well, I can't do anything else. It's a bit like the old TED Talks.
Yeah.
This
is all I know.
I achieved fuck all at school and I have no qualifications. Yeah. So what I've learnt over 25 years now is, I now feel qualified to start producing and start directing and doing all those things that I've been interested in for 10, 20 years. So that's sort of where I'd like to head into.
It's a beautiful thing. I love the... if you've got something to fall back on, you're likely to fall back outlook of that. Where it's like, you had nothing else to... If acting is all you know, then acting is what you're going to be
forward.
Doing. And your career is a great example of that. Because, again, there is stuff I want to talk about along the way, but let's get to Thrones, because that's the biggest TV show of all time. And you're one of the main characters in the biggest TV show of all time. But even then, you were... one of the few kind of established actors involved in it. I had John Bradley on, and it was mad to hear. He was like, it was my first gig.
I know.
It was like, it's literally,
it
he's out of acting school.
It's
so many
people's
first gigs.
And so many
of it was their first gig. And then you would have done tens of things that you're like, when you get the casting, you're like, this is going to be the one. And then it turns out it doesn't work, or one series happens, it doesn't click, or whatever else. So you can never know, and then Thrones comes along, and did you feel at the time that this is the one? No.
I mean, honestly, because we shot the pilot in a really low budget.
Yeah.
In a sort of freezing cold hall in the middle of Scotland, in the Highlands.
Amazing.
And I think all of us were like, what?
What are we doing?
What the fuck is this? Do you know what I mean?
And it was out of nowhere as well, because again, people forget that whilst there's a lot of fantasy type stuff. Now, there wasn't at that point. We were in the midst of vampire
laughed at this sort of genre. Yeah. People were like, so not cool, do you know what I mean? To even go
I guess
near that genre.
Lord of the Rings and that had happened, but still, that was Lord of the Rings. It felt like it was its own little thing. It didn't feel like that's a...
And it's sort of, Lord of the Rings sort of had that a bit of earthiness which Thrones sort of manages to have, and yeah. It's that thing, you know, it could be. And I do always ask every time we do a take, I'm like, can we do a camp take? Because the, you know, the Joan Crawford in me is like, it's so ripe for that.
Yeah.
And they're like, we haven't got the time, Lean. I'm like, no, I've been asking for like 8 years.
Yeah.
To sort of rein yeah. that in.
Yeah.
You know, because we're talking about dragons and grumpkins and, you yeah. know what I mean, Master of Coin and Raven. It's like, it's bonkers. So you've got to sit in a real seat of reality
yeah.
to make it what people see it to be and what people love about it and what people, you know, recognise in it.
Yeah.
It's a funny old thing, man.
And that's the beauty of it. One of my favourite things, because I became a fan late. Two Christmases ago, I watched, I think, the first 5 series just in a row. And I'd come out of a relationship.
I knew that was coming.
It was a tough Christmas. but I really enjoyed it. There was loads of dragons and sex. Best Christmas ever. But there was a podcast that I listened to, the Joe Rogan podcast, and Brendan Schaub is a guy on a podcast called The Fighting Kid. And they were all into it, except for this guy, Brendan, who's an ex-UFC fighter.
Right.
And he just kept saying, is there dragons? I'm cool. I don't need to watch it. I'm all good, thanks. And then following their podcast, and now he's the biggest fan of it. And he's got boots he wears. He's like, he refers to it as his Game of Thrones boots because they've got a big buckle on. And things like that. It's like, I love that. There can be that outlook of, or as you said there, it is silly. It's a silly idea. It's a silly thing that you're making. You've spent 8 years or however many years on something very silly.
Yes.
But it's wonderful. it's wonderful in what actually happens. It shouldn't be as wonderful
as it is. Well, it's our job. That's sort of like the perfect example of this job. Like you said earlier, yeah. we just get to play. Do you know what I mean? Which is, it is. I mean, I take the silliness really seriously. I like to find the truth in everything. Like I'm such a fucking nerd about it. And yet you're right. It's the most perfect example of how ridiculous it is.
Yeah.
And yet, it really works for some reason.
And generally, it really works. And I can imagine that as a tough one as an actor, because as some of the topics addressed, like, I mean, we've joked about the incest part, but it's an integral part to your character and the story, and it's really weird, and not many series have gone into that kind of weirdness, but it's had good points and low points. You know what I mean? There's been points where there's genuine affection and beauty, and there's been points where it's manic and hideous. But equally, just tons of really challenging storylines that you'll have to have got yourself into a really serious place in and really delve quite deep. And then on the next page, then a dragon comes. And it's like, that must be a hard one to get those performances in many ways and to get that seriousness out and to not just go for a kitsch take, because the realism in it is very real. And I mean, the prime example of the whole show, I think, is the Shame storyline that you did. That was heart-wrenching and powerful and, you know, a real emotional piece in this silly dragon show. How was that to kind of, to bring something like that into the forefront and into the, again, I was going to say into the real world, but into this world that's been built.
I mean, it was that the Walk of Shame was always what I knew was going to happen to Cersei. Like, I didn't know beyond that point. When I met David and Dan years ago, they were like, this is where she starts and that's where she ends. So that was the only storyline I sort of knew.
Right, that's fascinating.
And that,
because they took their time to get to it as well, which is beautifully so.
Yeah, and I was always excited to, I always knew there was a giant fall coming for Cersei. Yeah. And also, you know, we spoke about this the other day on set. We did a whole chat about 8 seasons about it, which was really sad, actually. I was like, oh, and then I suddenly realised, fuck, this has been 8 years of my life. It's going to be done. I'm not going back.
Yeah.
So to make that little piece there was just this accumulation of all of her denial and all of her sort of desperate moves. And her one mistake, Cersei's sort of one mistake. She's always like, I'll fucking show everybody that I'm right about everything. And there's a sort of child in Cersei that's very cross and doesn't want to listen to anybody because her dad was a shit.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where I sit with her a lot of the time.
Yeah. And it's wonderful as well, because it showed by taking a fictionally villainous character that you can go to all these extremes of what a despicable villainous human this is, and then managed to elicit an emotion of sympathy for that character.
Yeah.
That's huge. And I think, again, not to get over the top, but it's important in reality to use that example of look how evil this person is, but still there's stuff that people shouldn't have to go through and shouldn't be put through. To manage to get, if you'd said three seasons in that you're going to be feeling sorry
on for Cersei
at some point, you'd be like, no way.
Yeah.
Don't be stupid. And then you're cheering her on to take power again, essentially. It's like, that's amazing. And that's important because we are in a world now where we like things to be black and white of good guys and villains.
Yes.
But it's not as simple as that. Everyone is capable of either, in my opinion. Everyone is capable of
dark
great
and
beauty and great horror.
Yeah.
You know, we're always on the verge of that. And I think that, again, not to overread into it, I don't think I am overreading into it, but that really is told beautifully with Cersei's arc and her kind of her rise and fall and rise again.
Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, she's enjoyably complex. And what I liked about The Walk of Shame is she sort of breaks right at the end, just as she's going into the home and she's coming back to Qyburn and the mountain.
Yeah.
She's like, she can fall for a minute. But it lasts very, it's very brief, her sorrow, because immediately she's like, right.
Right, it's on.
Someone's going to fucking die.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's her, she just keeps going. Do you know what I mean? She's not going to lay down for anybody.
Do you feel you had a great, did you know her character when you started on the project? I said, if you knew the arc and the story, or do you feel it's a character that you've just got to know more and more as the years and seasons go on? They do. Again, it's crazy to have a project.
No, it's bonkers. It is bonkers. Nuts, isn't it? I feel ancient now. It's hilarious. I look back. We were all looking at pictures the other day. We were like, oh my gosh, it ruined us. We're so youthful. But yes, I think I've got to know her more. And I think I've sort of become more confident in my work just generally as an actor throughout the series. And I think because it's been consistent with one character, so you've been able to go different places. But also, you know, I try and make her funny sometimes, you know, within that sort of...
Yeah.
Without making her camp.
Yeah.
She has got a great sense of humour. So seeing all the shit she fucking lives through, all the... Look at all the things she's been through, do you know what I mean? And she's still standing.
Yeah. Is it scary or exciting that it's coming to an end? Because on one side, that's a huge part of your life. That's been people you've worked with for a long, long time.
Yeah,
but I don't equally, like any of them. there's a freedom now. Because again, when you are locked into a series, it is tough.
I think endings are always exciting and always scary, aren't they? Yeah. And it's the longest commitment I've ever made to anything. It's been 8 years.
Yeah.
And so it's quite there's a liberation about it.
And you're definitely getting to come out, I would imagine, feeling in a higher position than when you came in, right? Because you've come in, as you said, you felt that you were going from gig to gig at points or had been doing it a long time. And then you come into Thrones and now you're coming out again. As one of the few people who's been in there the whole run as well.
Yeah.
You know, so does that feel excited in that you're like, well, what's next now? Now I can pick a bit more. I can, as you were saying, if you wanted to direct or produce or write or any of these things, Thrones has kind of put you in a position to make that a far more realistic, you know.
Yeah, people let you indoors.
Wish, yeah, exactly.
A bit easier.
Yeah.
And listen to you. Do you know what I mean? You get taken a bit, you know, it's all bollocks.
Yeah,
because you go in and they kind of listen. It's weird. It's a weird place to be in.
Yeah.
Because of the show.
Yeah.
People will sit with you.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful in that I will be able to make my own stuff, which thrills me.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's exciting.
So what is ahead in that respect? Do you, is it immediate that you're wishing to make your own stuff as such, or are you have you been sitting there looking at, oh, I'd love to be involved in that, or I'd love, do you know what I mean? Are there projects that you'd love to jump in on that are already existing, or is it more, man, I'm going to start some new things that...
Yeah, new things.
That's great.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of bits in the works for later next year, which is really exciting.
Yeah. When do you finish up on June. Thrones? June. Because I think they've just announced it's going to be in 2019 now, isn't it, that it actually airs? Did someone say that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it is.
So you'll get to wrap then and have some time of going, oh,
Yeah.
It's over, and now what's next?
Yeah, that weird... I think it's that straight, isn't it? It's like human beings always think, oh, fuck, I want it to be done, or whatever, and then...
Yeah.
We always want the other side of something. It's,
yeah.
It's why we're so tortured, I think.
Completely. You can be in the best
thing in the world. So you're like, freedom, and then I think the door will shut, and you think, oh, fuck!
They've locked me out, I need to get back in there. I left my keys.
Yeah. Oh, I don't like it.
Well, I mean, I've rambled on loads, and we're getting close to the hour mark, and I wanted to talk about
to the
Band of Gold, because what a series that was. That's genuinely that's one that goes down as British in people forget about it. And as soon as you mention it, like, oh my god, that was amazing. It was only a few seasons long, but it was a hell of a series.
It was brilliant. I mean, Samantha Morton, I think that's sort of where she began. She was so fucking great in that.
She was just entrancing. Yeah. What an amazing performer.
Mesmerising. Yeah. And the writing was great, and it was sort of a bit of a groundbreaker.
There weren't a lot of shows that had a strong ensemble cast of women at that point. There might be Here's the Strong Woman or things like that, but there was a lot of different characters
identified
and layers.
As a strong woman, yeah.
Oh, it was loads of layers, and yeah, it was a great series. But what I do, again, the 300, there's loads of really
good
stuff.
Can I just say that, Pip, when I lost my passport, I lose passports all the time.
Brilliant.
And birth certificate, everything. And I had to take a Band of Gold annual to the passport office because I had no ID.
Amazing.
And I had to open the page and put it, and it was just...
This is
me dressed in leather with a nose ring. And I was like, honestly, have you ever seen it? Thank God she'd seen it. So she gave me a... But I was like, what the fuck do I take? I've got nothing. I have nothing that says who I am.
That's the absolute best. I've had the weird thing, and I've never had to do it.
It was called an annual. That's how old that
was. Yeah, that's proper, that. But I've had the weird thing of, obviously, I perform as Scroobius Pip. I act as Scroobius Pip. I've been Scroobius Pip. Even when I worked on a record store, everyone knew me as Pip. It's more a nickname than anything else. But I've had points before where I'm like, oh, they've put me on the list... A Scroobius Pip. I've not got any ID that says that. It's like, how much of a dick am I going to look if I bring up my Wikipedia page? look, here we go. I haven't yet, but I've had ones before. I'm like, I'm gonna have to. It's going to be out of my hand. If they won't let me in, then
video's coming out.
I had a meeting at one of the studios in LA, and then the big one, like where it's a casting in the actual studio, you walk across these lots of
Did you get the car park fear in LA?
Yeah.
Where you, it's,
you just turn up in the car park and then you have to go from somewhere and all this. And that was the one where I was like, oh shit.
They just give you a map and draw a line on it, don't they? Like a maze.
Yeah, completely. I was like, I don't know what I'm down as. I've not got any ID that says Scroobius Pip. That was the last time I had that fear, and it didn't happen. They'd put me down as David Meads, which was, you know, annoying and good. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about Dread, because I thought it was fantastic, and I thought, I'm a big comic book fan, I go and see all the comic book movies, even the shit ones, and I was ready for Dread not to blow me away. The original Judge Dread film wasn't great, and then that came out, and it blew me away. I thought the writing and the story was amazing. I think possibly it may be, I've always, me and my mate Chris have discussed what it's suffered from, because it should have been the biggest of the horror. The villain was amazing. The only thing I could come up with was it came out just after the Raid that had a similar story. And they were made, no way people could have known that was a story in Dread, in the comic book. So no one ripped anyone off. But it's like they had similar stories, so that might have affected. But how was that? It was such an amazing film for me. And as I said, one of the first films I was on the fence about this whole 3D malarkey. It felt like a gimmick. And that was the first film where they used it to shoot things beautifully. And the 3D was used. It made me think of a lot of Japanese cinematography and stuff like that. And it was amazing. The drug used by Mama and dealt by Mama was an amazing tool for cinematography. It could, and even more so in 3D, raindrops just falling down in slow motion and falling out of the screen at you. Made it a beautiful thing. It wasn't just, look at this.
Yeah.
It's flying past your head. It was these slow motion, beautiful bits of, wow,
yeah, it made you feel like you were in
rain.
It all.
So how was that to work on? Because it was a weird one, because it's a comic book, but it's not attached to any of the big houses as such. Therefore, you don't know if it's going to be a big thing or a small thing or whatever else.
It just felt like it felt like we were making an Indian, and the cinematographer, Anthony Don Mansell, who's a fucking genius, is a genius.
Yeah.
I think that's why it was so extraordinary, is he's an amazing man to just hang out with.
Yeah.
And his work is beautiful. And I think they kind of made this little, he looked like a Ghostbuster, like this little kind of backpack camera that had some three-way mirror in it that they shot some of the slow motion 3D on, which was, I don't know, I mean, it was, I hate 3D movies.
Yeah.
Hate them. And I loved that. I love that about Dread. Like, so it's quite poetic and all that slow-mo stuff.
Couldn't agree more. It's like it's a ride. One that I was like, I'm a big proponent of the cinema in general because I think that's the place to see films.
Yes.
Even as a film fan, you'll glance at your phone at home, or you'll notice something that needs tidying up, or there'll be a knock at the door. Whereas in the cinema, you're lost in that. And that was one that I just fought so hard for. I was like, it'll be good to watch at home. It's a great film, story-wise, pacing-wise, everything else, but it's a different experience.
Yeah, it was quite immersive,
because it was so immersive in 3D.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was great. So how was it as one to work on, though? Because it was, you're in, I guess you've done similar Thrones, but you were very much in a fictional world, and they built the kind of Mega City One type tower blocks and all that. Everyone looked very futuristic. How was that as a... Did that in a way make it easier to kind of go, right, I'm clearly to switch into character, if you know what I mean? Because you're in such a... You're having to suspend such disbelief as soon as you walk on set in the morning.
Well, it was... I mean, it was futuristic, but it felt... Because it was so grotty. It just felt like a broken... Yeah. Like, we could be in whoever knows, you know.
Yeah.
So it just felt, you know... I like to go against things sometimes. So you're expecting this kind of big dude gangster, but she was really just a broken, dead being. This woman.
And that's what I thought was so great about the performance, is it made her terrifying without
yelling
any extremity. Yeah. Again, it's that thing of if you want people to listen, talk quieter, so they have to be quiet and lean in and pay attention. And that's the vibe I got off your
interpretation. Yeah, I thought it was important for her to be what we perceive men to be, some sort of men baddies, without some sort of swaggering sexuality or any of that.
The reality is, the lead male baddie is rarely the big muscly guy. That's always the henchman or whatever else, and things like that. So why would you expect the female lead to be this tough? Villainesses
tend to be kind of sexy, you know, seductive, and I wanted her to just be fucking dead.
Yeah, and cold and terrifying.
Just waiting for someone to bring it.
Yeah.
Quietly.
I love it. Right, well, I mean, I'll wrap things up there as we're at the hour mark, and I know we've got a limited time, but what's, with everything that's ahead, is the motivation to do your own thing?
Unemployment and drought.
Exactly. Is the motivation to do your own projects motivated at all by family life? And the more control you've got over your work life, the more control you've got over your family life, right? Or does it not?
Well, you think that. I think we all like to think, but it's, you know, I still have to go away.
Yeah, of course. And again, I guess the more you take on, the more control-wise you take on, the more it is anyway. If you're plugging into someone else's project as such, you go away for a few weeks, that's it.
Whereas and they go, can you come for 3 days?
If you go away for a few weeks and then you come back and you're having to check emails about it and watch.
Yeah, or you know, I've got this project that I'm so excited about, and it's a book. I got the rights 3 years ago to it, and it's been in development since. And it's such a beautiful story. And we're taking our time finding the right people to kind of bring it to life. And already I'm kind of married to it, and I love being a mum so much. I also love when I find things that I'm passionate about work-wise. So finding that thing, not feeling guilty, is impossible.
Yeah.
And sort of leaving your children to have their own lives as well. Do you know what I mean? Not disrupting all of their mates and their stuff they do because you're doing what you do. It's really hard. It's like, what do you do? I don't know. Is it better to do that, or just leave them to it and do your thing and come back? I don't know. I'm never going to figure that out.
Yeah. It's just one that has to be tackled each gig at a time.
Yeah,
right?
And then you think, I'll just be a mum. And then, no, because I have to do stuff. I have to make stuff. It's in my fingers. I'd go mad if not.
And that's inspirational for children to see and watch, right? If you're just sitting at home being mum. Again, admittedly, they're ignoring it at this point. And being like, I don't give a shit about you touching a tarantula.
No.
Good luck to you. But ultimately, as
what's
a,
for tea?
As an inspiration there of, we're meant to teach our kids that they can strive for anything and achieve anything. So if as soon as you become mum as such, yeah, you stop striving for things, then that's not a good example to lead anyway, right?
No, it's good to, yes, exactly. It's good for them to see you. You have to go out and you work, you know, you work, but it's, yeah, it's also that, you know, strange thing I always say to my mom. It's not until you sort of hit 35, 40, you realise what your parents did, sacrificed.
Yeah.
It's really not. You just don't fucking get it.
Yeah.
So
I just assume, as we were saying before we started, you have the illusion that grown-ups exist. And there's this thing where they know what's going on. And then you get, I remember, as I said, I think it was when I hit about 30 that I was like, I don't really know what's going on yet still. I still feel like a child. But secretly.
Oh my God, nighttime's terrifying when everyone's in bed and you're like, oh. It's all up to me again in the morning.
Yeah,
I get that fucking fear.
Amazing. That's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
Well, from I am going to wrap up, I promise. But from the excitement of creating your own things, is there the excitement? Because I think from what I've seen of this industry, one of the great things is that whether a gig's good or bad, you get to work and meet new people and new creative people. Have you felt that that's kind of, you've been collecting people in the back of your head along the way that you know are great at this or great at that? Therefore, when you've got a project that you want to bring to life yourself, you've got the guy I worked with on this or the woman who works on that is amazing. And this person, I always remember talking to Stevie Graham on the project he's doing now. And in fact, when he did Boardwalk Empire, he'd worked with Scorsese, and Scorsese had always said, I'm going to use you again. And it was literally 15 years later, we just got a phone call out of the blue and said, can you play Al Capone? And it's like, that's 15 years later, and Stevie in his head has assumed that he worked with Scorsese and he's forgotten about it. It's like, no, it's always been there. And this is an industry where projects do take 15 years to ever see the light of day.
But when
it comes round,
it's your turn.
I've had you in mind.
You can't really ever forget Stevie Graham, to be fair.
No, of course, exactly.
But yeah, it's that thing of it takes a fucking long time to get it going. And yeah, you meet, you know, all kinds of people who do every kind of job and you just think, fuck, it'd be so exciting to do your own thing with them.
Yeah.
Beg them to do it.
Beg them to be involved.
Yeah, and, for ultimately no cash.
And engage. Just, but that's, again, that's the beauty of this industry as well, is that are working on Taboo and working on Walk Like a Panther as well were both things that the answer of yes came from pretty much everyone before their agents discussed the money and everything else. Because it was just, yeah, I want to work with them. This sounds cool. I like this project.
Yeah.
And that's the good thing about the industry, is when those things can still exist. And I think that's got to be becoming more and more of a thing now with the freedom of the internet and social media and wherever else. It's not as locked down by these big studios and they're the only ones who can make things happen. There seems to be a lot more now where creatives can have the power to go, no, we're going to make this happen.
Yeah, but like you say, people that go make, what was the great movie on the iPhone? Like,
A Tangerine.
Yeah. And
amazing film.
But people want, you know, they're the counter to the big studio films, which sound fucking great. And you're like, yeah, and you get well paid and the trailer's wicked and the snacks are awesome.
Yeah.
But there's not a huge amount
completely
of stimulation and joy and satisfaction and creativity and fucking adventure. So you do the little things and they give you that. They give you what you're really after, which is that feeling.
Yeah. I love it.
Black and white.
Yeah. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for sparing your time. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing if anyone survives Game of Thrones in the end, and all that's ahead.
And if the dragons were just a dream.
Yeah, it was all just an illusion.
Danny gets out of the shower.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pip.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Lena Headey. Fantastic, right? Huge thanks for her for allowing me to kick off the year so strong. That's the first guest of the year, and it's a strong one, and we're keeping on that strength, because next week we've got Paloma Faith, who, you know, her album came out at the end of last year and went straight to number one. So that's massive and exciting, and Paloma is one of my oldest friends as well. I've known Paloma for a good 10 years now. She was in A Beat That My Heart Skipped, a music video, which is my second single. So we've known each other a long time, so that's a great chat. Yeah, I won't say much more. Thank you all for tuning in. Hope you've all okay with going back to work and getting through this post-New Year, a New Year's Eve slump. And I'll see you all next week. Ta-ta.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.